Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the piloting of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is hosted by the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I will serve as a moderator for the show. Before we get started, I want to review some housekeeping issues. We want to try to make this as interactive as the technology allows. As a radio show, you'll be listening to this event live over the Internet, and therefore your computer speakers must be turned on. In order to ask a question on air, please dial 347-994-1149 if you want to jot that down. That number again is 347-994-1149, and then you will press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in a queue. Feel free to also log into the chat room. As this is our first show, we will be testing different modes of communication, so your patience is appreciated. Today we have Kim Brooks-Tandy and Al Gerhardstein joining us to discuss reforms that are happening in Ohio for incarcerated youth. These reforms stem from a sweeping settlement entered into 2 years ago out of a lawsuit known as SH v. Stickrath. Kim and Al served as plaintiff's counsel and are here to discuss the case, the role it has played in changing the system of care for juveniles, and their vision for continued reform. In addition to serving as plaintiff's counsel, Kim Brooks-Tandy is executive director and founder of the Children's Law Center. Kim serves as the coordinator for the Central Juvenile Defender Center and is a faculty member for NJDC's annual Defender Leadership Summit. She lectures and consults on juvenile justice, conditions of confinement, indigent defense, and education issues across the country. Al Gerhardstein is a civil rights attorney in Cincinnati, Ohio. For 34 years, he has represented victims of abuse in prisons and jails, victims of police brutality, victims of employment discrimination, and women denied full access to reproductive health services. He is the founder of the nonprofit Ohio Justice and Policy Center, which advocates for a comprehensive criminal justice reform. Kim and Al, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lauren.
Good to be here.
Kim, maybe we can start by giving our listeners some background on the case. For example, what is the scope of the lawsuit, and what were the conditions of confinement that led up to its filing?
Sure. This actually goes back almost 7 years now. Our office was involved in doing a statewide assessment of indigent defense, and this was back around 2003. As a result of that, the State Public Defender Office actually received some additional funds and began working again in some of the DYS facilities. Our early work there really was not focused on conditions, but what we found as a result of those attorneys beginning to do visits and to beginning to pick up appeals and other sort of post-conviction work from kids is a series of allegations that came to our attention, particularly in the girls' facility at Scioto at that point. And they were very serious. They were allegations of several allegations of sexual assault, sexual abuse of girls, some very serious injuries. And at the time when we brought that to the attention of the Department of Youth Services, then under a different director, he put an investigative team together and led by Fred Cohen, there was a series of reports generated, and frankly, we felt not much activity and not really addressed very seriously. So about 6 months later, in 2004, we filed a civil rights class action lawsuit against the department, and it was really, as time went on, there's a lot of history in between, but in essence, as time went on, we realized that the problems were very systemic and not just at that facility, and had the right opportunities available to expand the suit, get a commitment from this current administration for system-wide change from top to bottom. And so within about a year of additional fact-finding, we then entered into what became a very comprehensive settlement agreement signed about 2 years ago in May. In terms of scope, it encompasses almost every aspect of the facilities. But it did more than that. You know, it covered improvements in things like education and mental health and medical care and use of force and quelling violence. But it also created what we call a regionalization plan that is a really underlying all of this, a long-term plan that will close down big facilities, that will move kids into smaller community-based programs and have better results. So it's very comprehensive.
Great. Al, I don't know if you want to add anything about what the settlement requires the state to do, but how long did it take to reach such a comprehensive settlement, and what was the impetus to enter into a settlement?
Well, we had an agreement with the defendants, that is the people we sued, the people who run the Department of Youth Services, that we'd bring back this expert team to do the fact-finding in late 2007. Their report, which consisted of experts in mental health, in dental, in medical, in correction, classification, in safety, all those different areas, education, all those reports were filed with the court on December 31st, 2007, and they concluded that the entire system was failed to meet constitutional minima. So the incentive to sign a settlement agreement was either you go to court and have the court order you how to run your facilities, or you sit down and try to work it out with plaintiff's counsel. So we had intensive negotiations from January of 08 until April, signed off on a settlement agreement in April, and then had our fairness hearing, which is the hearing where the court looks at the deal you've cut and says, okay, this is fair to all the youth that are in the that are going to get the benefit of this, and signed off on it on April 21st, 2008. So that's fast. This whole effort was really not about the lawsuit. It's about triggering institutional reform. And if the lawsuit serves to keep everybody focused in this very difficult task, then we're doing good work.
Great. And speaking about institutional reform, one of the unique things about what happened in Ohio and the settlement were the guiding principles that really framed it. Kim, can you explain what those are?
Sure. Well, you know, it's 90 pages. The settlement itself is 90 pages, and so, but it starts with some very important premises, and you know, I guess I always describe it as we have sort of three levels of agreements here. You know, there were some real priority issues on safety and education that needed to be addressed right away. There were sort of the intermediate issues of how do we, you know, clean up facilities and get better services for kids. And then the third long-term issue had to do with the regionalization plan and how do we ultimately, what do we want this to look like, you know, in 5 years or in 10 years? I think the guiding principles lay out a process that at any of those levels, certain key characteristics need to be there in terms of decision making. You can read them all. Actually, the settlement actually is on our website, and we can give that out later. You can pull a copy of it. But you know, underlying, I think, all of it is the fact that these are kids and not adults, and they're different, and so it moves the state away from what I think had become a very adult model, particularly during the 1990s and early part of this decade into therapeutic and rehabilitative process with strong reentry planning, involvement of families and communities. And we stress throughout there that programming, it really needs to be looking at evidence-based and best practice kinds of approaches to things rather than doing what obviously hasn't worked and has resulted in very high recidivism rates. So it's really, you know, forcing decisions made with some principles that are based on good research, good science, and what good juvenile justice practices should look like.
Terrific. Another unique thing about the case is that Ohio has people called federal monitors. Can either of you please explain what their role is and who they are?
The federal monitor is Fred Cohen, and he has on his team a number of subject matter experts. He is a lawyer and a law professor, and he's done this sort of supervisory work in a number of cases in Ohio and elsewhere. And on his team are Dave Rausch and Cheryl Wills and Ava Crow, Steve Martin, and Orlando Martinez, Dr. Shansky. These are all people who have an expertise in a particular area. Dave Rausch has run juvenile facilities. Dr. Wills is a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist who has served incarcerated youth. Ava Crow is an education expert. Martin is a security expert. And every one of these people brings their expertise to the table. And what they're doing is in the first couple years of the settlement, they served as coaches as well as monitors. That is, they offered their technical expertise so that we could jumpstart the process of changing things within the system. And that usually started with developing new policies and procedures to match the terms of the decree. And as we move into the second half of the settlement implementation, we are doing more monitoring. Now it's time to see that the results have really taken root and that we're seeing the difference on the ground. And the monitors are shifting gears and doing more evaluative work and not just cheerleading and coaching and offering technical assistance. So it's a unique way to implement a federal consent decree, but I think it makes sense where we're all trying to accomplish the same goal of serving the kids so that they are successful on reentry.
And you just talked about sort of how roles have shifted a little bit 2 years in, but I do want to take a step back for some of our listeners. What has been the progress on the implementation of the settlement in the first 2 years? What has been the primary, you know, what was first the focus, why, and where are we falling on all of that?
Some of the biggest things that we have accomplished include lowering the population. I think when we started, we were at somewhere around 1,500 youth across the state. We're now down to about 850. And that's a good thing because one of the dramatic things we learned as we started working on this is that there are so many youth who were held in these large institutions, and the entire incarceration of them in large institutions was counterproductive. And we have some very good work from the University of Cincinnati showing that if you put a low-risk youth into a facility and then lock him up for an extended period of time, he's going to come out more likely to commit crime rather than less. So we're using that learning to take the right people and take them out of the institutions and put them back in the community where they belong. We've also had some very dramatic changes with respect to the release authority. There's more certainty about when youth will get out and what are the rules for determining when a youth will leave DYS custody. There's been a development, as I mentioned, of policies and procedures in most of the areas that we're seeking institutional reform so that there's a system for this. And there's been a change in philosophy with respect to just the normal staff. The routine staff people were called juvenile correctional officers. Now they're youth specialists. And it's not just a name game. It is a real effort to create a more holistic and supportive environment for youth when they're living on the staff who are going to be supportive of them. We've started to see some progress in other areas. We're eager to see some progress on rehabilitation. We're eager to see more progress on education. We have reduced some of the violence. It was a very, very violent system. Certainly staff on youth violence has been reduced. Youth on youth violence is still problematic. That's triggering, as we see it right now, too much seclusion. So that's one of the challenges we're trying to face so that we can hold youth safely without locking them down all the time. So we're making progress in all of these areas, but we've got a long way to go.
Kim, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
I think one of the most, I kind of think of this in two phases, I guess. One of the things that are actually happening in the community, the reductions in numbers and the community-based efforts, and I think that those have DYS is to be commended on the reduction in numbers and the work that they've done in local communities through Reclaim, which for anybody not familiar with that, is a financial incentive to counties to keep kids in their own communities. And more recently, Targeted Reclaim, which is targeting some of the six largest counties, providing additional funds because that is where the heaviest flow of kids into the system is. That is not directly part of the settlement. It wasn't a requirement to do it, but it was, I think, a smart way that DYS determined it could keep its numbers down and begin to close facilities. In terms of what still needs to happen, it's always been my hope that we can continue to see facility closures, that we have an end, as some states have called for, to the larger facilities. And so, I hope we continue to move in that direction and either close or significantly reduce in size and come up with some better small community-based programs.
And I have a lot more questions to ask both of you, but I just want to remind our audience that if you have a question, to dial 347-994-1149 and hit the number 1 on your keypad, and you will be screened to come on air. As the state and all the partners are engaging in this reform, what other models or state is Ohio looking to in making decisions or following?
Mm-hmm. I think that there is a I think there are a number of states right now that, because of financial and budgetary constraints, because of research, because of any number of factors, are beginning to do what Ohio is doing. And it's something that actually the state of Missouri did years ago in closing large facilities and developing small therapeutic models of serving kids that have very low recidivism rates. So, I don't know that Ohio is adopting a Missouri model per se, but I do think that the idea of the small cognitive behavior treatment centers is certainly based on that concept. I do want to mention one other initiative that's underway that I think is really critical. And in the case of Ohio, it was almost done backwards, but it's still very positive, and that is the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. The Casey Foundation, it is about somewhere between 15 and 20 years in terms of implementation. So they've tried this at a number of sites with very good results. But it lowers the number of kids going into detention. It provides alternatives to detention. It has had good results in terms of reducing racial disparities. And it's been cost savings without jeopardizing public safety. DYS, that model is now going national with the Casey Foundation. DYS took the lead in Ohio in getting Casey to come in and to work with what will be 5 counties now that recently kicked off JDAI initiatives. And so Lucas, Cuyahoga, Franklin, Montgomery, and Summit counties have all begun that process. The important part for the state, I think, is that JDAI has been, you know, we know statistically that the more kids come into that front end of the system, the more likely they are to remain in the system and to remain incarcerated, and particularly kids of color. So JDAI as a model has had a significant impact on the number of kids, not just at the front end, but the number of kids that get into the state system as a result. So it's one more effort, I think, to keep the numbers down in the state facilities, particularly from the counties that tend to be most significant feeder counties. So I think that is a real positive. I know that those five counties are well underway. There's a JDAI conference next week that they're all convening to see what other states have done and their progress. So, you know, it's another part of the system that I think can directly impact their numbers in the long run.
Are there other promising practices that are happening around Ohio or in other states that both of you are carefully watching to determine whether it's something Ohio should be doing?
Well, let me just say that if I'm a citizen and I'm listening to us jabber, I want to know whether I'm going to be any safer as a result of what these lawyers are doing. And that's what we should be watching for, is what is the public really thinking, and are they going to be supportive of these efforts? Because from the public's perspective, people want to be safe, they want to have that public safety delivered at the least cost, and they want it to be fair. And our reforms are addressing all of those things. And we are trying to make sure that the youth that come out of these facilities and come out of DYS custody are more likely to live a pro-social, cooperative life with their neighbors than ever before. And that's what all that programming is for. That's what all this evidence-based practices generates. And in the end, that'll cost less because we're holding on to youth for a shorter period of time and we're using the money as wisely as possible. And, of course, when you do that, you're the most fair. And related to this is the fact that there are things that we can't touch with the lawsuit that totally contradict what we're up to, namely gun specs. You know, some of these things that require mandatory minimums where the legislature, in a sentencing, in their effort to impose sentences, has said, well, if you were anywhere near a crime with a gun, then you're going to have to serve X number of years in the juvenile facilities. Well, we know that with our assessment instruments, that for some youth to serve that extra time will turn them into more fierce criminals. So we want the legislature to back off and see whether we can get some reforms into that kind of sentencing. And we want to make sure that there's always funding for diversion so that reclaim efforts, which is what we call it in Ohio, are funded vigorously so that we don't have to take kids into the system. So those are two of the things that we're watching and hoping that the legislature will act on.
You know, there's another initiative I'll throw out, Lauren, too. And, you know, state systems vary significantly in terms of how state correctional systems get kids. And in Ohio, you know, unlike Kentucky by comparison, a judge can commit a child to the Department of Youth Services, and the Department of Youth Services has an obligation then to house them in one of their correctional facilities, one of their secure correctional facilities. So there's 88 counties. There's 88 different ways of thinking about that. And until very recently, there really hasn't been any common assessment tools to look at risk and to look at criminologic need and that sort of thing. So one of the other pieces of research that has been done by the University of Cincinnati has resulted in the Ohio Youth Assessment System, which assesses kids at five different points in the system. But the majority of courts, I believe, have now adopted this and rolled it out. But it does it does make for more uniform types of assessments so that, you know, that youth who is maybe from a community with very limited resources, who's kind of the pain in the butt kid, but he hasn't really committed any serious or violent crimes, and maybe wouldn't have been looked at for commitment if he came from a larger county, may have a more equitable kind of disposition given what his needs level might be. So we're hoping that that assessment process will also keep kids out of this system that really don't need to be there. And I know that some other states actually are looking at that process, including Indiana, in terms of adopting a similar assessment process.
Well, Al, you mentioned about, you know, if you were the public listening, and I know that anytime people hear litigation, lawsuits, a lot of times there's like a visceral reaction to it. So when, I don't know if you have any advice for other states that may be thinking about institutional reform through litigation, what lessons can you both share about this experience?
Well, I've done a number of corrections, reform, class actions, and I think you have to be honest that they start from failure. I mean, the only reason lawyers get involved is that the other branches of government have failed so miserably to deliver conditions of confinement that meet constitutional minimum that they're actually at risk of being held liable under the U.S. Constitution for cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, that's a pretty sad thing. And that's particularly distressing when you look at the United States and its position in the world. So to get to the point where you need lawyers to solve your criminal justice problems is pretty sad. If there were a way that in other states legislatures could take the initiative before we get to lawsuits, that'd be great. And there are some efforts along those lines. I know the Council of State Governments have done some very good work giving advice to legislatures that know they're spending too much money, getting very little effectiveness for that. And those efforts from those types of nonprofits should be, you know, seized on. But if you don't have that kind of wisdom and you are facing the type of crisis that we described at the outset of this program, then litigation serves a great purpose because it focuses the decision makers in the executive branch, and it tells them that you have to make this a priority. There is no voting block for youth in a cell. There is no large number of voters that are going to rally behind the cause of youth that are stuck out in Franklin Furnace, Ohio. But there's a court with the power to hold people in contempt if you don't meet certain standards. And if that's what it takes to keep executive officials on task, in order to raise the minimum to treating people fairly, then that's the role of litigation. We've come up with a way to do even better than reach the constitutional minimum, but to use the litigation as a spark so that appropriate use of evidence-based practices can really come to Ohio and be infused throughout the programming with the kids. So I think litigation serves a great purpose. It's too bad if it has to be done, but if you're going to do it, I think the way we're doing it has the best chance of making a real difference in kids' lives.
But, you know, I think in addition, though, as I've looked at other states like Texas and California and, you know, things that Alabama, I mean, there are, to me, the ideal situation is if you don't have to litigate. Obviously, litigation can take years, and while it has a purpose, it is, you know, seems to be best combined with when other stars sort of align. So having an administration that is supportive, having advocates, groups that support you, having the leadership within the state that can bolster this. I don't think you can litigate away attitudes or perception. So there has to be, I think, ideally, to make real change, there has to be a shift in philosophy, and I think there has to be the support for that so that you have the foundation there on which to build. You know, the settlement is a piece of paper, and you can do it you can implement it well, or you can skim by. And obviously, a lot of time and energy went into this. So we want to see this have effective outcomes for kids.
And speaking of that, Kim, there may be attorneys who handle delinquency cases every day listening in who may not yet see some of the reforms at play. Is there anything they should know about this, how this could potentially affect their practice and the youth that they're representing?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think over the last several years it's affected practice in a number of ways. We do the annual training for the Ohio Public Defender Office for juvenile defenders around the state and have been trying to use that as a vehicle to educate them not only about the conditions that have existed so that they understand what their clients go to if they go to one of these facilities, and particularly a few years back, at the start of this, that was crucial. But it's still crucial because we know that institutionalization can have harmful effects on kids. So they need to understand that, and they need to advocate effectively at the disposition hearings for kids to remain in their own communities whenever possible. With targeted reclaim and with some of the alternatives and the funding that has been geared to local communities for behavioral health programs, for the alternatives to DYS, that's really critical. And so, you know, we've always said defense lawyers need to be better social workers in understanding the resources and what works and what can work for their clients in lieu of incarceration. I want to mention also, and this was really a separate piece of litigation, but, you know, initially we found not only that some of the conditions were problematic, but there were also was no way that a youth in one of those facilities could access the court in a way to get relief. And so, you know, a young girl who was being subjected to, you know, sexual conduct by a guard really had no access to an attorney unless she could afford one themselves, which these kids certainly don't. And so there is a separate program now that's been developed, the Legal Assistance Program. It's currently being run by the Mezebov firm in Cincinnati and has been very effective at meeting with those kids and investigating cases where there may be some relief due to that child through the court. So there are some other checks and balances, I think, with the legal assistance program, with what defenders understand about the case, as well as the Ohio Public Defender Office, who continues to look at, you know, the fact of and the duration of conditions in some cases where there may be legal challenges to that. You know, I am a big advocate that we don't stop advocacy once a kid is legal advocacy once a kid is leaves the courthouse and goes away to DYS or any facility. You know, there should be a strong system that follows that youth and that continues to protect their rights through incarceration and into reentry, for that matter.
So if I have you both on this show a year from now, what do you hope to be reporting?
Well, I would like to be reporting that the population has been reduced even more in these institutions, that we're truly just serving those youth that pose a threat to public safety, and we're serving them in a way that is making them less likely to commit crimes when they get out. I'd like to be reporting that I walked into an institution the other day and I looked at a kid's file, and people knew what a unified case plan was, and people had an idea, those treating him had an idea of what his reentry plan was, and there was actual work happening toward reentering him into society even though he's in the institution. I'd like to be reporting that you actually, when you walk into the institutions that are still operating, real treatment's happening. There's age-appropriate and criminogenic tendency-appropriate treatment going on, so that we're addressing the very things that trigger antisocial behavior in how we have those kids spend every day through their education program, through their other rehabilitation treatment programs. We need to have our very ambitious and visionary settlement agreement operating at full tilt in a year, because we want to be monitoring it for another year after that. That's simply making sure that all the details are taken care of.
I'd like to, let me add to that. I think we actually have produced two short videos that Roger Cohen has put together for us. One which supports the idea of what the concepts that are now built into House Bill 235 that was introduced by Tracy Hurd, which restores discretion back to juvenile court judges, and which allows individualized decision making rather than mandatory minimums. So those are two really important concepts that I'd like to see a year from now have been addressed legislatively, so that the reforms can really be implemented with all kids, and that we're not sort of stuck with some laws that hamper the progress that some kids have and actually are detrimental to them in terms of the long-term process. The second video that has been done, which is being distributed nationally, is really our vision for what a good system ought to look like, and it addresses several of the areas that we've talked about today in terms of effective advocacy throughout the process, through legal representation, so we're not forgetting those kids, effectively keeping kids out of the system that don't need to be there, particularly those low and moderate risk kids where we know incarceration is harmful and often makes them worse. And thirdly, that for those kids that do need to be confined for some period of time, we're not holding them longer than we need to, and we're doing effective programming with them. If there's one thing that I'd like to see, and I hope that we can enhance all of those provisions within the Ohio system in the next year, but if there's one thing in particular, is I don't want to have the same calls from the same kids a year from now. I don't want the kids that I'm dealing with now to be back in the system in another year. And that's ultimately the outcome. And I don't want them in the adult prison system either. But, you know, to me, that is ultimately the mark of success when we are getting these kids out, when we've provided the assistance that they can successfully reintegrate into the community and not return to the system.
Well, we are almost out of time. Are there any additional final thoughts either of you would like to share?
I'd like to just mention our website, where you can download some of the pleadings from this, certainly the settlement agreement, but also both of the videos. If anybody wants a hard copy of the videos, they can contact our office, and that's on the website. It's www.childrenslawky.org, or you can call our office. Our number is 859-431-3313.
Al, anything from you?
Well, only that I would hope that members of the public sense some hope here. Crime is not something that we should view as an unsolvable problem. We actually can make great inroads, and people are redeemable, and youth in particular. There's a tremendous amount of research out there that we are applying in Ohio that will actually make our state safer and our kids more productive. And I hope people see that and want to learn more about it.
Great. Thank you both for all that wonderful information. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. This show will be available on demand on Blog Talk Radio, and we will also make it downloadable as a podcast. As Kim indicated, if you want some more information about SH or the Ohio Reform, visit Children's Law Center website at childrenslawky.org. Linda Spears, Vice President of Policy and Public Affairs for the Child Welfare League of America, will be joining us on Spotlight on Youth on November 5th. To stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us here on Blog Talk Radio /Spotlight on Youth or become a member of one of two Facebook groups. Those groups are Partners for Youth Justice, Ohioans United for System Reform, or Children's Law Center, Inc., and we will be posting the events there. Have a good weekend, and we will see you next time here on Spotlight on Youth.